Hello and welcome to the Warfighter Podcast, Season 2, Episode 12. Hello, Tom.
Good morning, mate. Oh, it's been a bit of a gap, hasn't there, between the last episode and this one?
Yeah, look, we're not going to point fingers, but the logistics have got in the way of us, I'll admit. We are on the home straight, last few episodes in the can.
Yes, so with both guests we've got, I think, are, you know, have some value and experience to add to the conversation. It's going to be a good one. And that gap was just to make sure, we always say, don't we, Colin, it's quality, not quantity slash regularity, right? I mean, this chat's quite comprehensive and it's a huge topic, isn't it, Colin? So I feel like maybe we should skip the preamble for this one, give a bit of an introduction to the topic, the speaker, and then to step right into the chat. And maybe it gives us a bit of time after the conversation, as it is a humongous topic, to kind of do a bit of reflection.
It's something that interests me, but it's also one of those questions around realism. You're not going to deal with all of the subtopics in 40 minutes.
Yeah, so our guest is Anthony Pittman. He's the Director of Development and Optimization for Land Training over at Babcock International Group. And the topic, like Colin says, is all about realism. And that means so many things to lots of people. But we try to address it. We try and qualify what we mean during this conversation by realism. And then we go through it using his vast experience back in the military and also working for organizations such as Babcock to bring a bit of food for thought. And like what we always try and achieve with the Warfighter Podcast, it's just to stimulate the brain, think about different perspectives, take away the bits that are most relevant for you, and you, hopefully you can apply some of these thoughts or ideas to your everyday work.
Other thought before we go in is, we were a bit gloves off. I mean, I think we're getting a bit bold now with our interviewing. And it's like, right, you think you're getting an easy ride. And Anthony was a true gent, didn't dodge the questions and spoke from experience. So that's all we can ask.
Hi, thank you for giving us your time. I know you're busy, and you know this is one of our key chats on this series of the podcast. Now, listeners will know when we talk to potential guests, we ask them what's currently, you know, either frustrates them or they're passionate about. So the topic we've got today, which I think is going to be a great discussion, is around realism. And we all know realism means lots of things to lots of different people. But before we jump into that conversation and really understand what it means to you and going forward in the land domain, could you just give us a bit of background about yourself and how you find yourself in the role you do now?
Yeah, sure. I had a pretty nearly full career as a soldier. I was in the Queen's Dragoon Guards for my entire service. Mm-hmm. And when I wasn't at regimental duty, I spent most of my sort of staff appointments in the training environment, mainly in delivery. So actually doing the delivery of training, predominantly something like Exercise Wessex Storm, where we trained battle groups on Salisbury Plain. I spent time in Canada, and then I've also spent quite a bit of time in training policy branches. So a heavy training background interspersed with, you know, the operations of the day, Balkans, Iraq several times, and other trips into, you know, the States, Hong Kong, etc., all that kind of stuff. And then I moved into Babcock, and I ran a contract called Project Hannibal, which was delivery of training, design and delivery support to higher formation exercises like Cerberus and Rhino Staff and Charge and things like that. And then I moved across from that about a year ago into this development and optimization role, which is really trying to get more out of what we do. And, you know, realism is such a big part of all of that, because bringing realism to training for me is a bit of a passion, actually, and something I do feel really strongly about. So that's kind of how I've ended up where I am.
Perfect. And I think that we're very few better men to get on to have this chat. I mean, let's really take the bull by the horns here. If you speak to someone in the RAF or a pilot in the RAF, they're going to have different requirements for realism, what realism means to them, and it's the same for the land domain. So just to set the ground rules, the baseline, or whatever, however you want to define it, what does realism mean to you, especially when we talk about in training and within the land domain?
Okay, so I think you're right. Let's keep it to a couple of key areas. And I would say there are two gusting three key areas. The first is, you know, you need to have something that physically is realistic. Now, that can be in live, virtual, and constructive. But what that means is that the environment that you're operating in needs to replicate as close as possible to the real world. So that could be, you know, infrastructure or terrain, that kind of thing. So the physical is really important. Then there's human terrain, or in the terminology of today, audiences, actors, adversaries, and enemy, A3E. So you've got to populate that physical terrain with realistic human terrain. And then the third part is the threat. And that is what everybody kind of focuses it on, because a soldier's at the heart of your kind of mission, focusing on the enemy. So what is the threat? That threat's got to be realistic. And now it's really complex because it includes all of those things like cyber and information domain, etc. So I reckon those three things: physical terrain, human terrain or A3E, and then the threat, which is predominantly a subset of the human terrain.
My guess with this is all relative, and you're always doing trade-offs, because take your example of it has to be as close to physically realistic as possible. Of course, we can't shoot at each other or shoot tank-on-tank combat. That's very bad. People might die. But equally, it's very expensive to try and get physical training to be as close to the realities of war as we possibly can. And maybe that might prohibit it. So I'm probably putting words in your mouth, but I'm assuming, is there a balance associated with this? And how do we achieve that balance?
Yeah, there is a balance, because you're absolutely right. You know, there's a resource envelope and things have got to fit with inside it. And I think the balance is achieved by having sufficient realism to immerse the training audience in the problem of the day. Okay. So as long as you are in a situation where you don't ever think this is completely unrealistic, you're probably there or thereabouts. Now, the question and the balance is all about how much do you need for it to be realistic enough to, one, generate the necessary training outcomes, and there's a number of things in there, and also to cue the behaviors that are what you're trying to instill as a learning objective in that training audience. So if I see something, is it going to make me behave in a particular way that I can then demonstrate the skills that I'm trying to use to win? And, you know, we can count winning in a number of different areas, but that is what you're trying to do. How do I overcome the problem in front of me? And so as long as you can generate enough realism, then you will be able to cue those behaviors, which then become instinctive muscle memory, if you want, and you form a bank, don't you, that you can draw upon in the future. So when you're on operations, all of that stuff comes naturally back to you, because you have been in an environment that is as close to the operational environment as possible, that then triggers behaviors, be they tactical behaviors, be they decision-making behaviors, and allow you to then progress in a positive manner.
Yeah, a very small dip from me on that. I haven't used simunition very often, but I did in one training exercise where my patrol was basically going into a CQB scenario. And as a commander, you're going through your estimate process. And, you know, I had to go through things that I wouldn't normally go through, which is when I was picking the first guys who were going to go through the door, it was like, well, actually, which ones are not going to, because they would get shot. They would get the pain of being shot by simunition. So I was like, which soldiers did I think were more likely to go in with the aggression I required? And actually questions like, where do I put myself in the, you know, in the stack before we went into the compound to ensure that I could essentially give them some encouragement to get in through that door, that if I wasn't doing some training with simunition, I probably wouldn't have got that far in my thought process, because I just knew everyone would go through the process and I had faith that they knew, understood what they were doing. So adding that extra bit of simunition in to a scenario just not only allows soldiers to train better, but I think junior commanders as well.
Yeah, exactly that. And if you apply that same logic to aspects of our doctrine, for instance, in my experience, an officer, the leader, very rarely leads the patrol, as in is in the front vanguard of it, because he has to be able to sit back and make decisions when things go wrong, and things often go wrong at the front. So that only is reinforced time and time again if you're in a realistic environment where things do happen to the people at the front, and therefore you need to just, you know, be able to sit back, take stock, and make the appropriate decision at the time. So yeah, you're right. It is really important to deliver that realism that then cues your behaviors, reinforces your drills, underscores the doctrine as to why we do things the way we do.
Now, I don't think anyone that's gone through military training at any stage of history would have said, well, realism isn't really particularly that important to me while I'm doing my training. But do you think that realism is becoming increasingly important now? And if yes, why is that?
Yeah, definitely, Tom. I think it's more important now because training is expensive and it's time consuming. And so we need to optimize each opportunity. And there's a number of things that we're trying to achieve, I would have thought. These are just some of them that we want to get after when we embark on training. There's learning. So There is no point in doing any activity if you're not learning from it. Do it, reflect upon it, repeat, do it better, adapt, etc. So that's one of the things. The challenge of being in combat needs to be replicated in training as much as is possible. Safety issues to one side, as it were. And that challenge is increasingly complex. You know, the multi-domain environment we now operate in. The fact that we just call the human terrain actors, audiences, or audiences, actors, adversaries, and enemy. We used to just have the enemy. That was a result there. Now we've got a whole bunch of other players on the stage, and we have to deal with them. We either have to deal with them in a potentially kinetic way, or we have to change their behaviors. And some of it you can't do through physical violence. You have to be far more subtle. Then there's the cyber and information domain that is constantly now under threat and attack. We also need to, because that threat of which cyber is a part is evolving so quickly, what the Land Warfare Center would call the pacing threat is evolving so much, we need to be able to innovate to stay ahead of the game. And, you know, you're not going to get a new tank tomorrow. So you've got to innovate how you use the tank you've got today in order to overcome the latest threat. Look at something like unmanned aerial systems, drones, etc. You might have to do something simple like put cage armor over the top of the turret to stop a top attack or something like that. So that's really important. Then there's just betterment. You know, we've got to keep getting better. We've got to keep improving our performance. If we're not doing that in a realistic environment, we're probably not really doing it. And you'd get a unseen degradation of output where you all believe that what you're doing is really good, but actually it's getting worse and worse and worse. Then there's a strategic effect. You know, really good training in a realistic environment has a role in deterrence, because people can see that you are absolutely delivering hard-edged warfighting capability in your training. You're growing that, and it will make people think twice about, you know, maybe crossing the line and coming at you. I think all of those things underscore why it is so much more important than it probably used to be.
And I would also just say, and it probably underpins all of this, is it's soldier engagement. Troops like to do things that are realistic.
Yeah.
And they like to be doing things that feel, that make them feel like they are getting a quality experience. And I just think that more engaged soldiers are, then the better they perform, the more they learn. And I just think that's kind of, that all wraps around into what you were discussing.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on levels of realism. For example, if you're going through your basic training, should it be the same level of realism as you're going through your special to arms training or pre-deployment training?
Okay. To start with, there's a certain amount of training you need to do to just master the skill. Okay, so if that's driving something or operating something, you've got to be able to do that, and you've got to be able to do it with your eyes closed. So overloading the context in which you might be doing that, the realism factor, may be counterproductive too early on. So skill number one, be technically competent. Know what it is that you need to be able to do. Skill number two, which is right on the coattails of that, and becomes blurred as you move forward into that, is apply that skill in the context of the operating environment. So there is no point spending your life learning how to camouflage a vehicle in the middle of a football pitch just because there are no trees and twigs and things for, you know, camouflage nets to get caught on and become a complete nightmare. You know, initially you do it there, so you learn how to do it, and then you very quickly you transition into doing it in a wood or in an urban area or whatever the requirement is at the time. But it's a balance. And you want to be careful, I think, that we don't pat ourselves on the back for achieving an output, but not in the context of the warfighting that is such a fundamental part of.
Is it more correct to say that there's an optimal level of realism depending on what you're trying to do and depending what that bit is? So if I use the example of a school play, much of the set is papier-mâché, but that doesn't matter. You know, if my main characters are real and realistic and behave the right way, I can have fake buildings. So actually, we dial in realism depending on what for the optimal output?
I think that is true. You're right. You don't need to be confronting a bunch of T-72s to know that you're confronting an armored threat that is going to make you behave in a particular way. It's going to cue that action and reaction. So there are certain things that you probably need to be quite clear on in terms of delivering and resourcing accordingly. So if you want a high-rise building, you need a high-rise building. You can't really mess around with that very much, can you? But do you need a tank, for instance? Does a T-72 have to come at you, or can it be a representative armored fighting vehicle? And I've seen a couple of these recently, and in fact, I've just been involved in a trial this morning. It's finished, actually, where you can deliver a representative armored fighting vehicle that cues the necessary behaviors appropriate to the level of training that you are achieving at that time. And the same applies, you know, for something like targetry on a range. It doesn't have to be high-end to get the desired effect at the level of training that you're trying to achieve at the time. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. And I think the other part to my question is, yeah, I guess it relates to what you're trying to achieve with the training. So I'll pick one random example. But if your artillery barrage kills off all your infantry in training, I know you're doing it through instrumented live, and then the infantry go, well, we can't do our section attack because we don't have any people left. So what you end up doing is you kind of sort of orchestrate a non-representative set of events and go, this wouldn't actually happen, but what we're trying to do is a bit like when you go down the gym, you go and exercise all the body parts or what you're interested in exercising. You're trying to get the most out of that, I don't know, 2 weeks, whether you've got all the battalion. And so there's loads of things that, yeah, in a normal sequence of events wouldn't normally happen in this way, but I'm trying to make the most of the time available.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, how many times would the reserve be sitting on its bergens maybe for 5 days? But yeah, you don't want to do that when you've only got a week of training, so you have to keep deploying the reserve on various tasks, etc., which may be a bit unrealistic in terms of time and space. But you acknowledge that, okay, that's fine. The important thing is when that reserve is deployed, it enters a world of realistic activity. So there may have to be some decisions made that are not necessarily entirely realistic or in keeping with the command judgment that would normally be made. But there comes a point where you have to put that to one side, and the training audience very quickly gets immersed in a realistic environment and a realistic situation, and therefore has to start fighting for its life if necessary.
And that kind of brings us on to the how do we achieve realism, which again is a, you know, hospital pass of a question if I ever heard one, because it's just such an open-ended conversation along the lines of what is realistic. Is our current doctrine, should we say, that the way that we expect our adversaries to behave because it's written down, is that realistic? Or the new technique we've just seen on YouTube or whatever video platform of an enemy doing a certain activity using funky technology and drones, is that realistic? So how do we drive realism into our training without blowing up the training curriculum?
Yeah, it's a good question. I sort of think you need three key things. You need people, you need processes, and you need tools. So when I say people, that's fundamentally about changing the mindset, imbibing those people with knowledge. It doesn't necessarily have to be all based on recent experience or previous experience. It's knowledge. And this is a slight sort of tangent we're going off at, yeah, but soldiering is a profession of arms. It's a profession. And soldiers, I think, across the board should spend a bit more time enhancing their knowledge of the profession of arms. You wouldn't go to your doctor and feel very comfortable if he hadn't read the British Medical Journal for the last 5 years. Keep pace with what's going on. Yes, we do really well in formal training and courses and all of that sort of thing, but it's something that we should be doing anyway. We should just be enhancing our knowledge. And part of that knowledge includes training and how we train. What makes good training? We should teach people that. It's about imagination. It's about determination. It's about risk appetite. It's about integration of partners, products, and services. It's all kinds of things. But there's nothing wrong with actually teaching people that and then encouraging them to develop that skill throughout their career. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing you need is you need some processes. You know, you've always got to have a bit of process in anything you do. They're very important. That process is about making sure that you're current. It's about making sure that you have a design methodology that you follow and underpin. Doesn't have to be dogma, but it gives you a handrail. There's managing the execution of training, you know, integrating different effects and capabilities and being able to adjust it as you go along, because realism, again, bit of free play, and the activity needs to be able to be adjusted to account for unexpected decisions made by the training audience. And then you need ability to review that activity and learn from it, you know, after action reviews, that kind of thing, and wider force development, and exploit it. Those lessons have applicability across our force development. And then you need some tools, people, processes, and tools. You need tools. Start with the simple stuff like dressing. Go back to your analogy about the school play. You need dressing, and that is more difficult to achieve in the live environment. And these days, it's probably easier to achieve in the virtual and constructive, and particularly in the virtual, where you can create computer-generated imagery in order to deliver a really powerful virtual reality, maybe a 360 virtual reality tool that immerses you in that environment. But in the live environment, you're going to have to find people. You're going to need your audiences and your actors. You will need some enablers, an exercise management system, probably something like an observer mental system. You need data gathering. And all of this has got to be balanced between what is good enough and the resource envelope, including time. So I think to achieve realism, you need people who are in the right mindset. You need processes that are fit to deliver, and you need tools that allow you to create that environment.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds, again, very logical and sounds easier to describe on a podcast than probably it does to implement. One of the things we haven't yet touched upon, it all sounds pretty expensive. You know, people are expensive. To train people up with the right mindset is expensive. To then develop a process that works, that is flexible, that is agile, is also easy to say, hard to implement. And then obviously the tools and technology, again, complicated and expensive potentially. So is that the way forward?
No, it does not need to be expensive, Tom. It does not need to be expensive. That is what is so important. When I talked about the people, I said mindset, and that is the key thing. Okay, so it's about imbibing a mindset in people from the beginning. You know, training your soldiers should be the most important thing. And we should make that clear from the outset that if you're not increasing the lethality and survivability of your command, what are you doing? Because, you know, that is really important. Processes don't need to be expensive. These are things we already have. You know, we have a ton of exercise management systems and all that kind of stuff. It's about using it to ensure that what we're delivering is absolutely at the cutting edge of realism. I don't think we're talking about going out and, you know, buying a whole lot of new stuff. And tools, as we've touched on, it does not need to be expensive. Yes, some things probably do, but other things don't. And it's a trade-off, isn't it? You get sufficient to create the actions and reactions that you're after. And I mean, you know, we could give examples we have already, but I don't think this is automatically about going and buying a, you know, whole bunch of stuff that makes the world look like Ukraine tomorrow. That's not necessary. We need to do sufficient to create the complexity of Ukraine.
Talking about realism doesn't need to be expensive just really reminds me of a presentation that I saw, must have been 4-5 years ago now, at DESA, actually, so a defense expo. It was a talk from a staff sergeant, so a combat medic. It was just coming off, obviously, off the back of Afghanistan. He'd done numerous tours within high octane units, and he came back to train the next generation, and through necessity, because he felt the training wasn't quite, you know, up to standard and wasn't preparing them enough, he created, from a small budget, I think it was £500 or whatever he got from his unit, you know, he took a warehouse, he blacked it all out, he put in there, you know, speakers, strobe lights, smoke effects, just off his own initiative, and took a lesson on triage and applying a tourniquet or whatever it might have been into, and just elevated it to make it better. And it was such an inspirational demonstration and talk that and it stuck in my head, probably for all the wrong reasons, because I haven't really heard anyone else give a talk like that with such passion and evident value for money.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something there, Tom, because across the army, and look, a lot of what I'm saying is being done in the army, okay? It's being done in pockets of excellence, absolutely. I question whether it is joined up across the whole piece in order to just make it a bit more of a continuum, and we'll come back to that maybe later. What you've highlighted there is something that I think a lot of people will have experience of, which is the individual enthusiast. And they will go out of their way to make things happen and deliver betterment. But they then get posted. And because this thing hasn't been institutionalized, it probably withers on the vine slightly. and it's probably not funded formally. And maybe it doesn't have a formal role in a training pathway. And so it might disappear.
I'll jump in there and sort of reinforce that point. I think there's a bit of collective goldfish memory going on because, as you say, I was aware of stuff that we've done 10 years ago in the iStar domain. And then I saw a talk at a conference where a major stood up and said, we don't have this capability. I go, no, you did. Whether that project or the people have moved on and now you've lost it. So going back to your point, you lost that corporate knowledge. It's not institutionalized, but you did have it.
You know, I'm now numerous years removed from the training domain myself. So you know, I'm only speaking from experience and not current experience as well. So I want to be, I'm very well aware of that. So, you know, you mentioned institutionalizing this and it's important. So here's on my next grenade or hospital pass is how do we achieve that from your perspective?
Let me give some ideas. And these are, you know, this is not the definitive by any means. First of all, you've got to optimize the resources. Example, and this probably happens, but let's make sure it does happen everywhere. So when an anti-tank course, a javelin course is operating, does it dovetail its training, its exercises with some other combined arms event where a target array is readily available for it to use rather than it having to rely on a specific delivery task of X number of vehicles to achieve that course's effect? And I just wonder, I don't know, my experiences, not very often. Okay. So optimize the resources, tailor the event, be very clear on what it is you are trying to achieve in that event. What is the outcome that absolute must do? And then make sure that the activity and the realism associated with that activity is focused in that area. And that requires understanding what good looks like, what's good enough, and how you can deliver using your imagination on that. You got to know the start state. Know the start state of the training audience. Be really clear on what it is that they are able to do that they don't probably need to do again because they're pretty good at it already. The reality is we got to crack the things we don't do very well. And some of them are, you know, dull and boring, but they're really important. Road moves, getting to the line of departure. That's sometimes the most complex part of the operation.
Yep.
So build in the ability to adjust the training so that the commander can make, the training audience commander can make the decision he wants to make unconstrained by, oh, the DS have said, that kind of phrase. You just don't want to hear that. You want to rub it out. You must not run out of map when you are designing an exercise. Got to be able to cope with some pretty wacky ideas as long as they stay within the realism that is provided by the environment. And the training audience, you know, must understand that operating environment. And they must understand the scenario, the problem that they are trying to crack. And then it probably won't go badly off-piste. It might have some unusual, innovative ideas. It has to be encouraged. But you've got to be able to make sure you can adjust and stay within the bounds of reality. You know, throughout all of this, you focus on the mastery of a skill. Okay, so whatever that skill is that you're trying to achieve, just keep beating it until you get better and better and better at it. And I think there's another area, okay, that we haven't really got on top of at the moment, which is sort of intangible. Problem solving, collaboration amongst the team, almost human science behaviors, these sort of things. Because that is also part of realism. You know, when a team doesn't function, people have to be moved around. And it's knowledge that in quite a few headquarters, when we go to war at large scale, and I'm thinking particularly something like Second World War, a large number of key commanders were removed early on because they just weren't up to it. Well, we should have identified that early on because they either weren't good at problem solving or they didn't have a particularly inclusive command style or whatever it happened to be. But we can find those things out now. There are industry-provided tools, and the Army has some as well in its own armory, that we can identify where people have, I call them weaknesses, but they're challenges that we just need to overcome. You don't want to get rid of them. Why would you get rid of someone you've invested 15 years of training in, et cetera? Let's now find a way to make them better at what they do in those intangible areas. They might be very good at leading a patrol, but what are they like at delivering a back brief under fire in 30 seconds and absolutely ruthlessly focusing on other issues, but using the team to help them get to where they are? So I think those are really important bits that we can institutionalize and help increase the realism in training.
I think it's a huge topic. I think you've covered a lot of interesting ground, but the question in my mind, which I've always had, and I've not felt we've dealt with properly, is transfer of training analysis. So I'll give you an example from the flight training domain. I don't believe, or if anyone did, it wasn't very widely published, but I don't believe we ever really did a transfer of training analysis on motion versus non-motion. And the benefit of that might be that motion platform in a flight simulator actually adds a lot of cost and complexity.
Yeah.
The training. And the powers that be said, you got to have motion for this type of training. That's just the rule. And I think it was all based on opinion and, well, of course it's better. But there was very little evidence to say that you know, how do you quantify that? How much better is having motion, for example? And I was just wondering, when we look at all of these spectra of training, are you aware of any transfer of training analysis that goes in that says, this is the science that tells you what the best, you know, the optimum level is, or fidelity of a model, or whether you use VR or not? Is that sort of stuff going on?
I don't think it is going on, but it is something that is attracting increasing interest in industry, where I don't want to sort of bang the drum at Babcock, but I mean, they've got this thing called a human insight performance system where it measures how you react to, you know, the activity that's going on. And that can be either through wearable technologies or a number of other behavioral signatures. And therefore, that will allow you to determine whether or not you should have a 3DOF motion platform or not, because how you react goes back to this point of what's a good enough level of activity in terms of realism to cue the behavior you want. So if you jump into a non-motion simulator and you now get told the thing's spiraling out of control and you don't react, well, that's probably because physically you're not, or mentally you're not getting that stimulant, are you?
I think the problem is we've never run these things side by side. So proper scientific analysis would go, right, I'm going to split my training cadre into two. You lot turn left and you go to the non-motion. You lot turn right and you go to the full motion. And I'm going to do double blind. Now, all of that's quite labor intensive and complex to do. And you've, you know, there's lots of factors you've got to exclude.
It comes across as being a bit sort of geeky, doesn't it?
But unless people don't like it, right, you won't really truly understand what the sensitivities are in your training system.
My hypothesis is that obviously to build those training systems, money will have to get invested. So if we did do that test, Colin, and those 10 motion platforms, it turns out we don't need them anymore. Do you think we could turn them back to sender, or someone going to be on the hook for spending the multi-million pounds on a thing we didn't actually need? But I suppose the argument is that's going to save us in the future spending the multi-million pounds on a thing we didn't actually need. So
yeah, it's the old investor save. But it was a genuine question, and we don't have to take it to that extreme. But, you know, where can we objectively understand what that trade-off is, I guess?
We can measure it, can't we? We can measure human behavior, and therefore we can gather objective data to inform a decision as to the level of realism that is required to generate an appropriate mental or physical state. Can we not? So
you can measure how someone feels about something, and or they could self-assess, but actually the real measure is how they perform in the real world. You know, so for aircraft, you might use accident data or something, but that's over tens of years. And you go, right, okay, you could do a study across people that are non-motion versus motion, and then go, well, the accident rate's higher on these guys. Well, why? Is it because of that, or is it something else?
Yeah, but it's a heck of a lot research, of research, isn't it? Yeah, and time to bit of a utopian search.
A little bit. But, you know, I'm sure a great PhD thesis for somebody out there that... I think before we got into this topic, I was like, yes, let's talk about realism and training. After finishing this topic, I'm thinking we could have niched down a little bit, but I think hopefully this again is one of those classic primers that we do on the Warfighter podcast, where it sets that condition for a deeper dive later on in maybe season 3, where we take some of these points we've touched upon and really dig into them. Before we wrap up, Anthony, thank you so much for your time. Is there any other points you feel like we haven't done justice to, or you want to kind of shine a light on?
Yeah, such a broad topic, isn't it? I think there are a couple of areas that I think would be useful to touch on, and I'm happy to just shoot if you're content with that.
Hey.
Okay, so I think one of the things that is useful is that there's so much in realism, covers such a broad area, that if you want to have an organization like the Army maintain realism across a whole range of areas and different domains, etc., I think you need some kind of brain that is responsible for maintaining that and driving it. So it would be a training brain that would be responsible for driving change and adaptation, ensuring best practice is distributed across multiple different areas in terms of training delivery and design. It would harness academia. It would keep very close to the pacing threat. It would feed the mindset on how to deliver realism and training. So I think that is something that is definitely worth looking at. I think the business of human behaviors we've touched on is important, you know, identifying the challenges and then providing the individual with the tools that will allow them to overcome those challenges and form part of a high performance team. That I think is an area that is definitely worth another look. And then some ideas on how you might modernize training to be more realistic. And again, a lot of these are not, you know, they're not particularly new, and they are being done in certain places, but probably not everywhere. So what about having a common operating environment across the whole army that the army trains to be in for 12 to 24 months? Okay. That means that every single person in the army is in this operating environment. And for example, current focus, Eastern Europe. So you set the operating environment in Eastern Europe. You have the right kind of terrain as best you can, mindful of the trade-offs. You have the right human terrain, which you absolutely make appropriate to that kind of geography and that operating environment. And it then becomes a spine for all the other activities that you do at a much lower level. So even in individual training, when you're practicing in basic training, the lowest level of activity, you set it in that same operating environment. Obviously, a real microcosm of it, but everybody understands the threat, understands the human terrain, and it's just like a massive training campaign that the army undertakes for that period. What about things like a digital tute? Tutes are fantastic. I often think they're a much underused training means. What about a digital tute where you are able to understand the weapon effect in an urban area and what it would do to a building? So, you know, you might call down a fire mission on a particular area, but actually, funny old thing, it creates more obstacles than it does freedoms. But it would also allow you to have an opposing force that, you know, the threat could act against the blue plan, the training audience plan, inside that digital tute. So you draw the arrow on the map, you say, right, I'm going to use B Company to assault the obstacle. And because it's got artificial machine intelligence or machine learning in it, the op four reacts according to that. And now you start having a digital plan and execute medium in that tute. So you're looking at the ground, but you're also looking at the digital map on your tablet, and you get this action, counteraction, etc. So plan and execute, because the law is in the circumstance when you're executing, but when you're planning, the law is often in the doctrine. So you get best of both worlds there. Representative equipment, I think there's a lot we could do there. Okay, I think seeing the right thing allows you to cue behaviors, creates those memories that you draw upon in the future. As I said, I've just been out dealing with a representative armored fighting vehicle that costs a fraction of what an armored vehicle would cost, but it creates the same effect on the training audience. It's not a tank, because you need a tank to be a tank if you want it to be like that, but it's good enough. And go back to Colin's point about where's the threshold. Actors and audiences, I think that's really important. We don't need to populate the battle space with lots of people. We need to populate the battle space with thinking people who create frictions and conundrums for the training audience. Two people being difficult is more effective than a crowd of 20 people who are compliant and just kind of do what they're told to do. And I now think things like wargaming. We could do more from tactical wargaming, and we could do it online, and we could link that back to the profession of arms. You could make this interesting for people, make it challenging. Soldiers, by their very nature, are adversarial. Okay, we want competition. We want to win. So I think all of those are things that we can do, and I'm sure the Army is on it, and they're getting towards it, and industry is working with them. But I just think that now more than ever, we need to seize the moment, and maybe something like the, you know, Army Collective Training System, the Collective Training Transformation Program, will provide all of those sort of opportunities to bring this all together. Because at the end of the day, you know, realistic training is so important. It underpins positive activity. It provides learning. It's a key component of the engine for change in terms of force development. And it's rewarding. You know, we like doing good training, and realism provides good training. And at the end of the day, all of that improves readiness. And that's what the Army's about, being ready.
Yeah, well, thank you very much on that thought. It's been a great conversation. So much to think about and ruminate on. It's the kind of thing I might need to listen back to a few times. Thank you for the benefits of all your experience, both obviously in the military and in industry. I look forward to maybe getting you on season 3 and exploring some of these in further detail.
Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for allowing me to indulge my passion, which has been great. And thank you very much indeed. And thank you, Colin.
Yeah, it was that gloves off nature of that conversation, which I really, like you said, Colin, I appreciate. It's always nice just to get spitball ideas. Some are well formed, and then, you know, you and I will throw that curveball in, and then Anthony again has to kind of think on his feet and explore it in different perspectives. And you know, as you probably heard towards the end of that, that real appreciation of how complex this conversation around realism actually is, and how, you know, I'm sure there's people sitting there who have been screaming at the podcast, we're already doing this, look how amazing it is, here's a great example of the thing you're talking about. It's like, yes, you're doing a great job there, but how do we proliferate that across the whole organization?
And we did pull a few threads that we covered before, which is great, common themes building. But I'm always reminded of the film A Few Good Men with Jack Nicholson, where he stands up and goes, realism? You can't handle realism. No, he doesn't say that. He says something else. But I always like, I think, be careful what you wish for. If you really want this, industry can deliver. I've always been able to. And I actually think it's latent capability to do so. But a lot of the time, I'm not even saying we're making life easy for ourselves, but we're manufacturing this to maybe make the training effective, or there's some practicalities, or as we said, you don't want one unit sitting on a Bergens for 2 weeks, which is what I would actually happen if you go, this is what's really going to be like.
Anthony talking about the vehicle that they'd converted to look like an armored vehicle, they actually showed me a video of that, and it looks pretty, you know, pretty bob on. And if I was in my little OP position and I see that trundling over the hill towards me, that's going to get my heart rate going a lot more than, I don't know, what do we currently use? Those static armored carcasses that just never moved and everyone knows where they were on a training area. That's what we've had before, unless, Colin, you can correct me and tell me there's another example.
I think the concepts are not new. They've been trialed at different levels of fidelity. But that doesn't mean they're a bad idea. It just means we need, you know, like we said, we're still got what I call a corporate goldfish memory. So we do stuff that's excellent 10 years ago, kind of collectively forget about it, and it's not implemented as a standard part of training.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think probably I forget regularly, because it's very easy, like you say, to sit here on a podcast and say, this is the way it should be done, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it's bringing in the right levels of realism for the level of training you achieve. And maybe it's just a commentary on the level of training that I achieved during my time in the military, that I never rarely got to the stage where it was super important to add super realism or super relevant to operational theatres. If I spent a lot of time in the higher echelon units who are higher levels of readiness, maybe I'd have a different perspective on this.
I think my takeaway, when I to big up our sponsor and people who work for him, but people like Anthony, it does give me faith in the military, because there are people like that. Yes, they work for a large prime, but they actually genuinely care about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If the authority says, we want to do this, they'll do everything they can to make it happen. Like, so there's loads of people like that. I meet them every day who actually want to help, not because there's a financial incentive, because they just want to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something getting in the way. So I think a lot of it isn't necessarily about finding we need to find a new startup technology to implement this. Actually, yeah, you might need a bit of that, but a lot of it's like, you can just do it with what you've got already and make it better. It's just, I don't know, there's a commercial issue, or the right people aren't given access to it that can help you. So I don't think it's we can't do it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it comes back to that creativity conversation, and you're right, you know, maybe these bigger organizations, it's when you're looking for your staff, it's about finding the people that, like you say, passionately care about actually delivering a quality product and have the ability to think outside the box in order to deliver on that, not just go, what's the computer answer to this problem? Oh, it's spend more money. It's actually, no, let's be creative and make sure we're getting decent kind of return investment pay, or whatever that might be. Are we at the end of the podcast, do you think?
I think, bear in mind, our discussion went on a bit, I mean, in a good way. I think, yes.
Something to look forward to is the final episode. So Colonel Arnell David, US Army, has agreed to come back on the Warfighter podcast. He was our first guest on the first ever episode of the Warfighter on season 1. and he's going to come back. He's moved into some really exciting roles and to do some very interesting research that definitely want to look forward to in the next couple of weeks or so.
We've already done the recording and he's very annoying because he's one of these people who go, how do you find the time to do all this?
Yes, 100%. Like,
so, oh, you do this as well? Right, okay, let's talk. So, but excellent discussion and a great way to end the season. So look out for that one shortly.